ॐ सहनावतु सहनभुनक्तु सहवीर्यङ्करवावहै तेजस्विनामधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषाव जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सरि गौर भक्त वृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
Okay, page 55A. The problem with authority, Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. So it means Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra are the problem with authority?
Yes.
Or you mean the problem with authority, and authority is defined as Guru, Sadhu, and
Correct.
Shastra. Okay. Okay. The problem with authorities, we have gurus, we have sadhus, we have shastras. This is a problem. Okay. During the formative years of the Christian religion, right, you know, and the sahajiyas, they get rid of all of that, right? They don't have any of this problem, right? You know?
Okay. Bogus guru, bogus sadhu, yeah. Bogus
shastra. Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. During the formative years of the Christian religion, sincere attempts are made to address the problem of authority by establishing a kind of civic succession. Unfortunately, little clue could be found within Christ's teachings as to whom should adopt the post, since Christ never delved into such specific administrative details. In the first Christian generation, command of the church lay with Jesus, Jesus' next of kin, or in those whom he had appointed as apostles and missionaries. In reminiscence of the Jad Goswami Apasampradaya, all attempts to establish a hereditary family lordship in the church failed. Among the Gentile, non-Jewish congregations, the apostles sent by Jesus enjoyed supreme authority. But once they had all died, there was an acute question concerning leadership. The documents of the third and fourth Christian generations are chiefly concerned with the question, who's in charge?
A question we never hear.
Huh?
A question we never hear.
Yeah. Yeah. Early in the second century, prominent church figures included Bishop Ignatius of Antioch, Bishop Clement of Rome, and Irenaeus of Lyons advocated an apostolic succession, the notion that it is the bishops who stand in direct line of succession from the apostles. They favored a distinct hierarchy within the church congregation, broadly consisting of clergy, bishops, priests, deacons, and laity, laymen. The clergy were responsible for preaching, for administering baptism and Eucharist, and for distributing aid to the poor. Bishops in particular, they insisted, were the nexus of the order, the truly authorized teachers, without whose authority there could be no sacrament and no church. And here, bishops, and where do the cardinals fit in? They're just big bishops, or they're actually in another category?
At this time, I think at this early stage, they hadn't established that.
Okay, so there's only bishops.
But I think they're equivalent in this book, more or less.
Okay. Okay. Okay, so in other words, they don't have that understanding of the cyclic succession, that someone has studied under someone, learned something nicely, and then they pass it down. So it generally kind of developed, but it wasn't necessarily a strong principal position. Just that the bishops were, but that the bishop, how he learned or how he gained his bishopness, wasn't necessarily defined by having learned from another bishop. Like that. I mean, it's just he did some outstanding work in that and became elevated to a bishop. So that makes sense. So it's kind of some semblance of a parampara, but not exact like that. See, the point, Jesus didn't have to worry about it because there are already church authorities. You know what I'm saying? It means he already had, the Jewish religion already had its system, so you didn't have to create a new one. That's the idea. You just had to carry on the teachings. That's why there's no need to discuss a hierarchy. Because you see is that the founder acharyas, they generally establish a mission, a system, and how the authority works and everything like that. We see that, you know, Madhva, Ramanuja, Prabhasan, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. It means they would establish how it works. They would discuss Bhaktivinoda Thakur, you know, how the mission would work. But he didn't discuss that, so that would indicate there's no need of a new institution. There's only an understanding within the already existing. Does that make sense? Early heretical movements, the Gnostics.
But Srila Prabhupada, he didn't establish some kind of not an institution, but a movement.
Yes. No. But I'm saying Prabhupada, he made GBC, he made temple president, the relationship between them, the relationship between the devotees and the president. What makes a temple? You know, your president, your secretary, your treasurer. You know, the temples are independent. They're not, how you say, there's no central management. You know, all these different things he established so that things would go on. The BBT, the ISKCON, the two are separate. You know, because if management fails, the book should go on, because you can start again. You know, like the phoenix, you can rise from the ashes if you have the books. So you want to keep them separate, because otherwise if they're too interrelated, then if one goes down, the other goes down. But it should be that it continues. Or if something happens with the BBT, then the individuals are there, they'll start the printing again. Does that make sense? So you have these kind of elements. Does that make sense? You know, how initiation is authorized, what are qualifications for initiation, you know, what is the qualification of someone giving initiation, a disciple, you know, a preacher, does that make sense? So you would say is he established an institution. But what we're just making the point here is that they're saying, well, Jesus didn't discuss it because there was no need. He wasn't trying to make a new institution. It was just an understanding within the already existing institution. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I don't understand how they miss the point.
How do they miss the point? It's called, there's one officer who's specifically in charge of seeing that people miss the point. And amazingly, because I mean, one would be very pleased to know that it is not one of these, you know, how you say, masculine, you know, machissimo kind of, yeah, like this. It's actually Maya, right? You know, so I mean, it's quite liberal, quite modern. You know, there's just a lady in charge. You know, say what you like, but there's a lady in charge of the whole thing, and it's her business to see that they always miss the point. Huh? Yeah. Because the thing is that if teachings aren't the predominant, what happens? It goes into sentiment, right? So then the difficulty comes up here by these later generations, you know, your third, fourth generation. You're already talking that because if Paul becomes the prominent person, because the other ones, he came 50 years later. So that means he's definitely some, you know, 25, 30 years or something younger than these others, or unless he took up the mission much later in life. But in any case, he's younger than the apostles. So that means when the apostles die, then there's Paul, and he's outspoken, he's active, he's dynamic, he has an opinion. You know what I'm saying? So then it's going to go that direction, and he took it in the direction of it's not about the teachings, it's about deifying the person. Right? In other words, how well you deify Jesus is how well situated you are in the religion. Right? So we see is that then teachings, if it's not the main, it goes into sentiment. So then the first problem is going to be form. Right? Does that make sense? You know, what is the form? What is the element, rather than what's the purpose of the form? You know, why do you need someone in charge? You know, what's the purpose? Because it becomes more of an administrative. It means you do have the element of ritual. Okay, nice. They created their ritual. Because by this time, then, what did he say? We had here? Baptism, Eucharist, and distributing aid to the poor. Okay, now Jesus did baptism. Like that. And I'm not sure, is that, you know, you, there's a bath thing in the Judaic.
Yeah.
Yeah, it means bath is a standard. It means if you want to convert, you have to take a bath. You know, so there's always...
If you want to become Jew, at the end of the very last point of the ceremony, that you take the mass in mikveh. It's a yeah. special tool.
Yes. So in bath...
Then you're coming out, you're Jew.
Yes, okay. So what if you just stay in the water?
For 1 year, you don't wear other clothes.
That's
just the last
thing. Oh.
One year is minimum study to become a Jew.
Okay.
There's one interesting story. Is that one lady, she came to Israel, she studied through the whole year. And then she comes to that mikveh, to the pool. And then the water in the pool is, she doesn't know what's the water like. And it's really cold. She goes in and cries out, "Oh, Jesus." Failed completely and out. No second chance.
No second chance. She'd have to go to another country or something.
What's she supposed to say? Oy vey?
Oy vey?
Oh, Moses. Well, yeah, she could have explained. Well, it was bad. That's why I said Jesus. It was good. I would have said, "Ooh, Moses, I love this."
Just the mention of it is
that was it.
Favor.
Permanent stamp. Right? Yeah. Go to the pastor and say, "You're the one that said Jesus." Okay. Do they make it really cold on purpose?
It's cold.
Because it's a tank. Not that they have ice in the bottom.
No.
Just to see what they'll say.
It's not mean.
Yeah.
For themselves, they keep it warm.
Oh, okay. I bet for these things. Okay. And they occasionally like drop in some miniature sharks or anything just to see.
That was an inquisition, right? There are two sides, God, and another side, the devil. And on God's side, there was a hot plate, hot floor. So when you entered into the room and went to God's side, it was burning hot, so you jumped to the devil, and then you sent to, you see, his... That was a such ritual. He's a heretic. He's a heretic, so he should be hanged. He put some symbols of God and altar, something like this, and all the elements of God, of the devil. But the floor was a hot, blazing iron plate.
Okay.
So when you stepped on it, you couldn't stay, so you jumped. The same as a heretic.
Yeah. Fertile brain. Okay. Early heretical movements, the Gnostics. This point bore great significance when the established church was confronted by the Gnostics, an important movement in the early Christian centuries. Gnosticism hails from the Greek word gnostikos, one who has gnosis or secret knowledge, which in turn stems from the Sanskrit word jnana. Their conflict with the church came to a head in the late second century. The Gnostics claimed to possess special charismatic spiritual gifts, making them privy to secret oral traditions whispered by Jesus to his disciple and not contained in publicly accessible records such as the Gospels. They thus offered an alternative to emerging Orthodox Christian teachings and were hence swiftly branded as heretical. Gnostics taught that the world was created by a demiurge or satanic power, which they often associated with the God of the Old Testament, and that there is total opposition between this world and God. Redemption was viewed as liberation from the chaos of a creation derived from either incompetent or malevolent powers. The Gnostics held a Docetist Christology, in which Jesus only appeared to assume the flesh, although not assuming material form according to the Gnostics. Jesus, nonetheless, was the Redeemer sent by God to reveal his special gnosis. Okay. Yeah, then the problem is that because there's so much problems in the world, so it has to be made by someone who's bad, rather than the element of karma that we're bad, therefore it turns out this way. You know?
So they actually are the same, but just propagating different ideas.
Basically, it's just that, you know, they have the secret knowledge, and so something is, they come up with these things. Because the problem is they'll say all this is out, but there is the element of the demiurge aspect. That the God mentioned that walked with Adam and Eve is not the original personality of Godhead. There is that, some have that idea, so it may be left over from these guys. That kind of a thing. Yes?
Yeah, I think that their idea was...
Some say that. Does that mean that specific group, or you're saying that's what the Gnostics?
The Gnostics' idea
is that. You know, in other words, it puts into a different position the God is described in the Old Testament is not the God described in the New Testament. So then you completely separate the religions, because otherwise, originally, it's one religion. Just it's a matter of understanding. But now with this, you would make two separate religions. So.
And also in the first paragraph, it becomes clear that these apostles who were preaching to the Gentiles, they were in Rome, like Paul, so they had money to propagate a lot more what they were, their ideas. And then I think they became dominant, and that's how they actually get Rome to start off accepting Christianity.
Oh, because they were there.
They were there, and they had money, they had influence, and they changed the principles that we were discussing before.
Okay. So the originals didn't seem to as much, because that was always a problem between the original apostles and then Paul.
Yes.
Is that element of that adjustment. Mm-hmm. You know? But it seems that they were comfortable that he was preaching to the non-Jews, probably because they didn't take it as much as so consequential, right? If they had understood that later on that they would be the prominence and then come back and give the Jews trouble, then they might have taken it more seriously about either not having him do that or, some other approach. But they probably didn't think that the non-Jews would take it so seriously. You know, a few here and there, okay, but.
The priest was telling me that some of this...
A little louder?
Some of the original descendants of the apostles, when they came to Rome to preach what they had heard, or somewhat of what they had heard, and they just saw that everybody was taking this religion, but it meant nothing to them. It just was like a title. I'm a Christian. It didn't have anything to do with culture, with tradition, with anything. It was just like... All the world become Hare Krishna without following the principles and anything. So they just lost a lot of their power, their impetus to preach.
Okay. Because
before it was real, like, live or die and preach.
Well, technically it kind of was. You know, it's like you lived or you ended up as a torch at one of the at the Colosseum. You know, it's just a matter of who ran faster. That's all. that's it.
So his point was, as soon as it became...
Yeah, in any case, you know, the Christian ideology of being illuminating, you know, maintained. You know, either you did it through your words or you did it through your body, one or the other. Yeah, no, it's there. But the thing is that's the difficulty when it's not a lifestyle. then it becomes superficial. Because the point is they didn't change. They're Romans by culture. But then they were monotheistic instead of pantheistic. But in one sense, philosophically, that's an improvement. But at the same time, it's not that solid of an improvement, because that one God still is not personal. Though sentimentally you think that way, but philosophically it's not. So, it's just getting, it's a bit better. But then the problem is they don't have the lifestyle to back it up, because the Roman lifestyle matched with the Roman gods. But the problem is Christianity, by breaking away from Judaism, has no culture. So either you're Jewish or you're pagan. Right? And so then the problem is then the pagan, it doesn't match with monotheism. So that means technically Christianity has no culture. Right? Does that make sense? So that even today, what is Christian culture? There isn't specifically. I mean, over time you get it, your somewhat of European kind of value system is the culture. And they've developed their, things from Latin and this and that, but even that's being dropped a lot, and play around with cups and wine a bit, and stuff like that, and you do things. But where does it come from? Where is the authorization for that? So it's just developed. So then they have something, but then the problem is that's only, they've only developed ritual. But what is the Christian clothes? Okay, the priest has something. But what does the common man do? How do you run your business? How do you interact with others? So the earlier Christians, there was some more of a concept of that, but it gets lost. So that's the problem, is that the culture is to live the philosophy. But the problem is this new philosophy didn't have an application as a culture. You know what I'm saying? So it's weak that way. Yes.
Historically, I don't really understand. When Paul was preaching, he was preaching to the Romans, actually?
Yeah, because at that time, we don't hear that he went up north and was talking to the Germans. So basically it would be, it means those of the Roman Empire. How many of them were actually Roman citizens? But I would expect that Paul would have a tendency to, since he had become one at great expense, to move in those circles. Right, but others, probably didn't.
But they already had some culture.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. They had their existing Roman, particular pagan culture.
So he was establishing faith.
The faith, leave the culture as the Roman, but have the faith in Jesus. But then the problem is the Roman thing is, your food's connected, your sacrifices are connected, your child's going on a, going away to school, and they have to go for, how you say, 5 days travel to get there so that they'll be safe. There's a sacrifice. You know what I'm saying? But in Christianity, where is this kind of thing? Okay, so you pray to God, nice. So that's good, but the problem is they will ritualize things. So then their rituals just still remain pagan. So technically a Christian is monotheistic by philosophy and pagan by culture. That's actually a Christian. So now what aspect of pagan? Then that's, it basically means Western European. If it's Eastern European, they're called East Orthodox,
yeah.
Like that. But if they're Western European, then that'll be coming from the Catholicism. So even your Protestants are a derivative of Catholicism, not of East Orthodox, or they didn't branch out into a different culture. It's similar, just the rituals are different, but the lifestyle is the same. You wouldn't be able to tell the difference between an atheist, a Christian, Catholic, or a Protestant. They would all dress and act the same way. So there is no culture. There is no... that's what I'm saying. It's just whatever's the common... if you take the pagan culture, strip it of its specific elements of demigod worship, then that's what you have left. And if it's anything scientific or anything that takes a little brain, then you get rid of that, because it's all about faith. So then you end up creating a culture that's at the lowest common denominator of just ordinary life. right? So all the things of science, this and that, were destroyed. Because all these things of science were already there, but they took until the 1700s really to come up again. They were already happening at this time. So the difference between science in the, you know, in the first couple of centuries and science in the 1600s, 1700s were at the same place. So there had been a 1500 year or 1400 year just gap, because it was seen that these sciences were connected with the pagans, so therefore they have to go. You know, fortunately they left it that you could eat food, right? You know, pagans ate food, so we shouldn't eat food, right? You know, because they didn't go, you know, kosher. You know, so that means then they just kind of left the food alone. You know. Yeah, like that. Otherwise, it would have died out really quickly. You know? We wouldn't have any. We wouldn't have, you know, A through what is it, F or something like that. You know, here to look at. You know? Yes.
This idea that Jesus is God came later.
It seems to be started by Paul, and then it's a matter of different groups take it different ways. Like here, he only appeared. To assume the flesh, so, but actually it's transcendental, you know, like that. But the whole thing is, because they don't know what actually is the body and what's the soul. Like, we don't have a problem that you have a Nitya Siddha come, you know, and is in a physical material body, because it's the soul that's the Nitya Siddha, not the body. Right? And then the conditioning that they'll appear to have will be according to what's going to be useful for their preaching. You know, so Krishna arranges that. So they'll, you know, appear in a certain family with a certain body, certain abilities to be able to perform their particular mission. Does that make sense? Yeah. So then, so we don't have, it's not a discussion that we have, but because they can't tell the difference between the soul and the body. And because of the neophyte element that if anything's wrong, it's all wrong. Or if something's right, it all has to be, you know, the one way, unable to distinguish, lack of that intelligence. Then the whole thing comes up is about what is the nature of his divinity. As we'll see, all these elements just are that's the big, it means for most it'll be the difference between one church, one brand of Christianity, the other will be the particular rituals or this or that. That's not actually the main difference. The main difference is on the divinity of Christ. You know, and whether you eat him or not. Basically. Like that. You know, these are big. As I mentioned, what I mentioned here, the baptism, Eucharist, and distributing aid to the poor. So distributing aid to the poor, anybody has to do if you want to be a world religion. Right? There's no aid and there's no welfare work. There is not, they don't have the world religion element. Right? So therefore baptism and Eucharist. These are the bottom line of it. You know? Like that. So, you know, and then the point is that if it is his body and his blood, then if he's not divine, then what are we eating? You know, so therefore, you know, better he's divine. Right? You know, so it's all mixed together, right? You know, it's all mixed together. So it becomes a little freaky. But this, I mean, it means we laugh, but the actual breakings of the church from each other is all over that. Not, you know, then there'll be details of that, of, you know, how much ritual, how much this, whether they use this or that. Those are side points. Those come up after. But their actual fundamental basis of being Christians comes down to that. You know, it's as simple. Ours is that, you know, the soul, God, and the material world. So these three. So it's fine that it is there. But the problem is they don't have the knowledge to actually define these things. Right? You know what I'm saying? Yes.
So it seems that the church after Jesus Christ left was not very clear.
No, it's not clear. Because it means, what is it? You're leaving it in the hands of those that are not necessarily so developed. Some of them may have been, so unless they... But the point is how many people are... understand very well. You know, like we see here, it says in original, the ideal would have been, okay, it was his family members and those original apostles. Now, if somehow or another it could have gone down in bloodlines from there, then it probably would have been really easy for them.
Yes.
Right? You know. But the thing is it's not. You know, there's always talk of the, how you say, underground idea that, you know, there is a bloodline for Christ, and that's what, you know, what is it, what is those Knights Templar, that's what they're doing, is trying to protect that line and, you know, all that kind of jazz. You know, then it makes it really easy, because then you can get out there and fight and this and that, but, you know, otherwise. So it didn't seem to work, because it's basically, it was, you know, Jesus' mother, then his, I think his sister, and Mary Magdalene. These were them and Peter were basically your prominent persons. You know, like that. So if others don't catch the mood, then it kind of dissipates. That's why this principle of just studying to catch the mood, right, means technically you look at it, just the Vedic concept. Now, here is you have clergy and then you have the layman, right? And so then you would expect a certain amount of study and everything from the clergy, right? So definitely there is some, but then how much they continue? You know, how analytical is it more than just reading, right? How much of a study is it? So you know theologians study, but you don't necessarily know that the clergy studies. Generally speaking, they're more intellectual and they are well studied. Otherwise, how do they answer questions and become respected as someone who has an authority? So generally speaking, it will work out that way. You know, so like bishops and stuff like that. But your regular priest, right, then it's not necessarily that he's well studied. He just knows how to answer any of the emotional things that come up. But if it goes beyond that, they generally don't deal with it. You know, it means it's either they just, you know, pull away. You know, means now they'll just pull back. But earlier, then they could say you're, a demon, and then burn you at the stake, and then, you know, discussion's over. You know, so then, you know.
Yeah. When you become priest, they don't finish school, kind of thing.
Then I know there's some kind of study that there would be definitely. But I'm just saying is that they've studied, so there is that element. But then how much they're working on the intellectual aspect or how much it's just on feelings. That's my point. Like theologians, you know, will continue analyzing the whole thing. Okay? Now we're saying, and that so that means within the clergy that there's only a portion of it that you would know would be, take that as prominent. Right? Because your main clergy are just going to be your priests. They may or may not know. Then your higher levels, then generally as it goes up, you expect them to be more shastra, right? But how many of them are there, right? Does that make sense? And then you have the layman, you know, so when we're talking about 3 billion Christians, you know, we're talking about, you know, some hundreds of thousands of clergy, and the rest is laymen, right? Okay, now, but now we see within the Vedic system, you have those who are priests, you know, that took care of the ritual in the temple. But as far as the teachings of the Vedic culture, it wasn't specifically with the priests. The priests should know that, but you would have other scholars and others, and that could be anybody. Does that make sense?
Those are the Brahminical
group? Yes, the Brahminical group. So it's broader, because the point is you have let's say you have a Krishna community. Then you have one priest there. And then there's a few of those communities, and then there'll be something above that, you know, the deacon, or as it goes up till you get to the bishop. You know, so the bishop may be over, I don't know, a part of a country, you know, depends how big it is. Like that. So then, how did you get into that?
You're talking the proportion of laymen.
No, yeah. I mean.
Yes, but now how many people in that little community are intellectuals? Right? There may be so many, but they're not the ones that are forwarding or training or teaching Christianity. Right? So it becomes reduced down to simply the ritual aspect. That it's based on that. That's all that's going to carry it on. Well, in the Vedic system, it's the Brahmins who are giving that knowledge. But now, what's creating the environment that knowledge can be done? That's the Kshatriyas, right? But they're also then trained in this, right? And then you have to have, for it to be a community, there has to be an economic basis. That means the Vaishyas. Does that make sense? So technically only the Shudras would be your laymen, technically. But at the same time is as Vaishnavas, then they themselves would be knowing and studying the philosophy and giving that to family and friends and taking part. Does that make sense? So you don't have this division in this way of those who are living and practicing and those who just kind of identify with. Does that make sense? There's a difference here. Like you see, devotees in general, they're studying. You know what I'm saying? Just like we're sitting here and studying. But now, within this kind of arrangement, this would be persons who are going to become priests. Right? Does that make sense? But here it is, we're just ISKCON devotees. Do you understand? So it's much more dynamic. Like, because that association is much greater. It's a much better, how you say, machine. This is not a very efficient machine. Right? Does that make sense? Because then it has limitations on how effective it can be. Right? Does that make sense? Yes.
My question. In the 80s and 90s, there was a book written by Pritu Prabhu regarding Christ and Krishna. Let's compare these two personalities. My question is that the informations there in this book are authorized regarding that Jesus, for example, that Jesus was in India, that after crucifixion he actually didn't die.
Oh, that's taken from the Essenian Bible, I think. So for Christians who accept the Essenian Bible, it'll go great. For those who don't, then you're going to have a problem. Then you're, you know, preaching on behalf of the devil. You know, in other words, it's an all-encompassing thing. Anything they don't understand or like, it's just it's the devil. Right? And if you don't have any authority, then they'll just, you know, make a face. And if they have any authority, then, you know, you have burning of the stake, you have racks, it's fertile brain there. They came up with a lot of varieties of interesting things. Does that make sense? So in other words, the natural thing is just that discussion and study. Like means like devotees in the program, technically there's 2 hours a day a class, and then probably expected reading on your own. So that's 4 hours a day you'll be associating with the books and discussing Krishna consciousness. That's just scheduled. Then naturally there'll be more than that. Right? So if you're saying 4 hours a day of actual study of the books, you know, and that's what everybody does, what community does like that. Right? So that's the Vedic community. It's much more, because the point is human beings. Right? In other words, human is special. Then you have leaders amongst humans. So it means all the humans are supposed to be doing that. Does that make sense? Reincarnation and origin. Origin. Sounds like some kind of bio company or something.
Spirulina.
Reincarnation and origin. Yeah. The conflict between Christianity and Gnosticism is of special interest to followers of the Vedic culture. For it was at that epoch that the notion of transmigration of the eternal soul were divorced from biblical teachings. While contemporary churches lend little credence to the concept of reincarnation, it was in fact a ready option for first wave Christians. In the first 4 centuries AD, early church fathers such as Clement of Alexandria, Justin Martyr, Saint Georgia of Nyssa, Arnobius, Saint Augustine, and Saint Jerome all embraced reincarnationist concepts. To understand how and why these ideas became anathemized, one must first gain a deeper understanding of Orthodox Christianity's relationship to Gnosticism. What is now called Gnosticism was not alien to early Christianity, but permeated its history during the first few hundred years. The latest textual discoveries reveal an effect far greater than previously thought. What you're saying is some of these elements that they were saying in there is discussed today, but it's just somehow or another, it as a movement, and specifically that particular group focusing on that, that's been thrown out. But it's not that it affects it isn't there, because it was basically non-different. It's just a matter of where they emphasized. And so those who emphasized too much this way, they became that group. The common misunderstanding, past and present, has been to confuse pro-reincarnation elements in the church with Gnostics. Thus, when church leaders waged an intense campaign against Gnosticism, people assumed that reincarnation was also taboo, right? Because they talked about it, but it didn't mean that the church also wasn't talking about it. So there was, in other words, the fight wasn't over reincarnation, the fight was over something else. But because they also did that, then it went along with it. Particularly, reincarnation was closely associated with Origen, A.D. 185-254. Oh, Origen was a person. Okay. By far the greatest thinker and biblical scholar of his day. Moreover, among all the Christian fathers, with the possible exception of Augustine, Origen is held to be the foremost church genius. So that means even up to today, or just the founding, kind of?
At that time.
Throughout the whole history of Christianity, it is clear that no literature except the Bible itself wielded a greater authority in the church than Origen's writing did in their later time. That means?
It means that his writings were on the level of the Bible.
Oh, his writings were in the level of the Bible. Okay, yeah. So it means the authority of the Bible and the authority of his teachings were considered comparable. Okay. But some 300 years after his death, it seemed that a general council of the church had condemned Origen. Between the emperor Justinian and the church, the handling of the Origen controversy generated a murkiness about reincarnation that has continued in Christendom to this day. So in other words, Origen supported reincarnation. Okay. Many popular books on reincarnation pinpoint the Second Council of Constantinople, the Fifth Ecumenical Council of the Church, in AD 553 as the official end to Origen and reincarnation in Christianity. Footnote 1. The Seven Ecumenical Councils. So these are the ones that are common between the East and the Catholic Orthodox, right? Because you have East Orthodox, you have the Catholic as Orthodox, and you have the Oriental Orthodox. So these seven are common to the East and the Catholic. I think the Oriental Orthodox came out, I think, after the second or something, or at the between, I think, or with the third they separated off, something like that. So it would mean this one here. This.
Yeah, it explains the 1054.
Okay. The seven ecumenical councils. Mm-hmm. An ecumenical council is an official ad hoc gathering of church leaders meant to settle church business and establish a unified Christendom, called with less frequency than regular church gatherings, such as synods. They were convened in order to resolve major disputes into Christian doctrine. The three major branches of the church, Orthodox, Catholics, and Protestant, recognized seven ecumenical councils. As we're saying, but the...
Within Orthodox, you have further sub-branches.
Oh, okay.
Eastern and
Oriental. Okay. So Orthodox is just meaning the East. Okay.
Yeah.
Recognize seven ecumenical councils. Nicaea, 325. Constantinople, 381. Ephesus, 431. Chalcedon, 451. Constantinople, 2, 553. Constantinople, 3, 680. Nicaea, 2, 787. Oh, so it opened and closed with Nicaea.
Yeah.
And the constant, so you just have the Ephesus and Chalcedon, 1, 2, 3, 4. Because there was something very major, this Chalcedon also. Further ecumenical councils were rendered impossible by the widening split between Eastern Orthodox and Greek-speaking and Western Catholic Latin-speaking churches, a split that was rendered official in 1054 and has not yet been healed. In addition to these universally acknowledged councils, the Catholic Church recognizes a further 14 ecumenical councils. Okay, so the 21 means including the 7, not 21 after. Okay, yeah. But these were councils of only the Catholic Church and are not recognized by the Orthodox or Protestant Church. That makes sense? So, in other words, the theology up to the, through the 7, that's common between all of these.
Mm-hmm.
Then after that, then each may have their own ecumenical councils.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why these 7 are always, you always talk about the 7.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's this. Yeah. In Catholicism, then they'll talk about the 21, but the first 7 are common. Then there's 14 of their own.
Mm-hmm. Will we talk about the major split?
Talk about the major split.
So why they used to have those councils? Together,
it's called the East-West Schism.
It's coming up.
Yeah.
Yes, it's coming. It's coming.
And then after that, there's the schism between the Catholics and the Protestants.
Yeah, Catholics and Protestants. But you don't deal so much with the Oriental.
We'll get into that. Within the Eastern controversies.
Okay. So in other words, it was East and West, and then East split into Orthodox and. I mean, into Oriental and
yeah.
East,
yeah.
And then the other split into Catholic and
but
Protestant.
But there's so many. There's like Egyptian Orthodoxy, Assyrian Orthodoxy, you know, so many different types of Oriental and Eastern.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean,
so
even in Catholicism, I think there's over 200 denominations that are not considered heretical.
Yeah.
Like that, yeah. Because you don't have to, that's the one thing about them, at least you don't have to worry. You know, if they're heretics, it doesn't continue because they, you know, they killed them all. You know, it works good. You know. Okay. This council, how'd you say? Anathematized. Isn't English so wonderful? You have the same letter, but it has, you know, so many ways to say it. Anathematized. Right, you know, there's something. Anathematized. Okay. Condemned the doctrine of preexistence of the soul and by implication, its transmigration to different physical bodies. Okay. Article 1 taken from the council in 553 may be of interest. So this is the second... Okay, this is the fifth one, so it's the second Constantinople. Quote, if anyone assert the fabulous preexistence of souls and shall assert the monstrous restoration which follows from it, let him be anathema. Okay, condemned. Okay.
What's their problem?
Well, by this time, then they, it seems the mentality is closed in around them so much that then, because now they call it a fabulous pre-existence, means that, in other words, it's just kind of just, you know, a wonderful story, but it's not. Well, before you had thinkers that could discuss these things.
Mm-hmm.
And the amazing thing, this is just a few hundred years. Yeah. But I mean, the first 200 you're saying that was kind of there.
Yeah, it was a concept.
Yeah, so in 300 years it had gone from, you know, just a normal concept to completely, you know, how you say, condemned. The Seven Ecumenical Councils of the Undivided Church, Volume 14, Series 2. Volume 14. It sounds like it's a very large work. Yeah. They concluded the above in spite of the many allusions to transmigration, like in Jeremiah, for example, quote, "When the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Before I formed thee in the belly, I knew thee, and therefore thou camest forth out of the womb, I sanctified thee. And before thou camest forth out of the womb, I sanctified thee." So in other words, he's saying here he knew him even before he's in the womb, and then while he's in the womb, he's already been sanctified. Right? So I guess that's, if you're a more strict follower, that's why you don't get into abortion. Because if you can be sanctified in the womb, then you wouldn't. You know. Jeremiah 1:5. Jeremiah is part of the New Testament.
Yeah.
Since Origen was popularly associated with reincarnation, and since he was supposed to have...
Is it? Hmm? It sounds like a Hebrew name.
Jeremiah, that's Old Testament.
Sounds like it.
But it's not one of the five books.
I just don't know the English term.
Yirmiyahu?
Yeah, it's an Old Testament.
Old Testament. Okay, so that means that it even goes back further. So yeah. So I wonder if reincarnation is there amongst the Jewish things. It's still there, or no one worries about it?
Huh? Is it specific?
Huh?
There is only Jewish souls.
No, of course. So then what are the others? Just manifestations of life symptoms. Combinations of matter.
Who cares?
Yeah, oh, I see. It comes down to that. Who cares? It's not even, it's worthy of a scientific explanation. So who cares? But they do discuss how the original 600,000 Jewish souls in the Sinai who came out of Egypt, that those have been divided and make all the so many millions that are there now.
Yeah.
So now if everybody's just part of a soul, and there's such a personality, what were the original souls like? They must have been really, really powerful like that. And then where were those 600,000 when there were less Jews? When there was only Abraham, then, you know, or he was equivalent to 600,000 like that.
Yeah,
you know, and then slowly.
He lived longer, divided up.
Yeah. It could be. Yeah.
Weird philosophies.
Yeah. That's why we're discussing it in this section. That's where it comes up. Okay. Since Origen was popularly associated with reincarnation, and since he was supposed to have deviated from orthodoxy, people have assumed that reincarnation and Christianity are incompatible. The scholar Geddes McGregor gives a detailed account of this history in his book, Reincarnation in Christianity. A Christian theologian and emeritus distinguished professor of philosophy. That's a pretty good title. Emeritus distinguished professor of philosophy. At the University of Southern California. Then he just lost it there, you know. An emeritus distinguished professor of philosophy at UCLA.
LA.
Yeah. Emeritus distinguished professor of philosophy. You have to say Oxford or Harvard or, you know, like that. Yeah. Okay. McGregor concludes that the facts do not support a clear-cut resolution of the issue. By the 6th century, Origenism had probably come quite remote from Origen himself, such as Neoplatoism went beyond Plato, or Neo-Darwinism exceed Darwin. A monastic community in Palestine known as New Laura had become the center for intellectual monks who aligned themselves with the Origenist movement. Their affinity for doctrines such as those of pre-existent souls, that's what they call it, pre-existent souls, right, rather than just souls that are eternal. That's interesting, pre-existent.
I think the soul is manufactured at the time of birth.
Yeah, so yeah, it's just yeah. So it's So that means it's taken from matter. So it's just another. It's just karma. You know, the karma is that matter. Well, actually, all material thought is life comes from matter. Mm-hmm. It's only Vedanta then you get that life is beyond matter. Mm. So then here, then they drop from actually a possible transcendental elements of philosophy down into just basically mundane. Mm-hmm. Yes.
In that book, Christianity and Krishna Consciousness by Satyaraj.
A little louder.
He mentions that in this second Constantinople council, when it's decided that reincarnation is gone, one prominent element was that if you had two lives, you could make a mistake, you might have another chance. But if you just have one, then you have to listen to the church, otherwise you're condemned forever. So that argument quit that control of the church over the country, over the people. So that was kind of a strong political...
It's more of a political consideration, managerial, yeah. Yeah, who's in charge? that's what it comes down. I mean, that's the difficulty. Control and enjoyment is the whole thing of the, you know, so control and facility is the security, you know, for the feminine nature. And so the soul being that, then naturally that's going to be, if it's not connected to the Lord, then it will be, you know, come up in all kinds of strange and wonderful ways. But the problem is as they disconnect, then it's harder. Then you have a problem of defining Jesus, because if Jesus was already there, you know, then it's just he comes into the body and he moves on, so it's not to do with the body, so it makes it very easy. But if you separate that, then that becomes a very, very difficult element. Their affinity for doctrines such as those of pre-existent souls and universal salvation began to get them into hot water. The monks' opponents succeeded in getting Emperor Justinian to write a letter to the Patriarch of Constantinople. The brief named Origen, dead for several hundred years, as one of several pernicious heretics. At the command of Justinian, a synod was convened at Constantinople in 543, and an edict was issued, setting forth a list of errors attributed to Origen. So this synod is not one of the...
No, 10 years before the...
Oh, okay. 10 years before the second Constantinople. Okay. This edict, besides refuting the errors, was supposed to promote peace between East and West, but it only divided them further. This point, if it's not transcendental, it won't. There is no material solution. You know, there's only transcendental solutions, right? That material can't solve itself. Right? These are examples. You can't wash blood out with blood. Right? It just is not going to work. So you can only transcendence can actually purify.
I think also there is a connection with the break of the Eastern Roman Empire and the.
Western
Roman Empire. So politically, there's a
break. Yeah, there's also the political, like that, because around this time, it would have been, I think it's earlier. I think the break between the two came in the 400s. Yeah, because I think Rome fell apart in 400s, like that. But Constantinople went another 1,000 years. Yeah, they went to 1400. Then I think the Ottomans took over. Yes.
Marso, it means that whenever they were doing this seven councils, whenever they were establishing something, they rewrote again Bible?
That's another, I don't know if that comes up in the discussion. Whether they would re-edit the Bible, I don't know. I'm not sure when the St. James Version, I'm not sure when that is, when that came up.
Much later.
Yeah, that I know of.
The Anglican
yeah, these are much later because that's a very popular one. And then the basis of this, because there is a difference between the Christian version of the Bible and the original Old Testament. I mean, there's just sections left out. You just don't have them because they're just, I guess, considered politically incorrect. They have a philosophical problems with them. you know, difficulties like that. Pope Vigilius initially opposed the imperial order, right? Because this is just established by the king, like that. But it had the support of a certain group of Christians, and so therefore, then it flies amongst the Christians. Because otherwise, if the king says something, it's not that anybody, the you know, religious movement specifically cares, you know. But it was that. The religious group used the government to affect their work, right? Okay, Pope Vigilius. Pope Vigilius initially opposed the imperial order. Consequently, he broke off communication with his supporter, the Patriarch of Constantinople. Then the Pope himself arrived in Constantinople, whereupon he suddenly reversed himself, carefully not to allow that the emperor had any clout in theological issues. Pope Vigilius issued a document condemning the writings that Emperor Justinian's edict had already cursed. Right, because the point is then the government's in control, when the point is they want the church to be in control of the church elements. Right? The Pope's document, however, was vehemently denounced by bishops in Gaul, North Africa, and elsewhere. Consequently, in 550, Pope Vigilius withdrew it just 3 years before the council that is believed to have finished off Origen. So, in other words, it had already started the discussion, mm-hmm. right? And so then going on for some time, so this is, 7 years. So then in that time it goes on, it becomes an issue, and then when it comes up, then as officially, then at that time it was removed. You understand? So then one group is using the political for their benefit, then to avoid the political actually having the control, then they do something else. That creates then a whole problem within the church. The story just begins there. Okay, so it's just beginning. The Origenist squabble was a rather minor side issue amid major geopolitical and ecclesiastical maneuvers. Meanwhile, the monks who called themselves Origenists split into two groups. In 553, Emperor Justinian was ready for action again. He convened the whole church in the Second Council of Constantinople, also known as the Fifth Ecumenical Council of the Church. To delineate Justinian's motives would require a lengthy political analysis. In short, the goal of the emperor's statecraft was to unite East and West. Coincidentally, he wanted to condemn a doctrine known as Nestorianism. The writings of Nestorius, banned by Justinian back in 543, had nothing to do with Origen. The Nestorian heresies were the stated cause of the convocation, not Origenism. Right, so it's just Origen got thrown in the mix, right? Because it had already done before, so you might as well, why not? The extent, if any, to which Origenism is really condemned at the Ecumenical Council is, to say the least, questionable. The Ecumenical Council was convened on May 5th, 553, under the presidency of the Patriarch of Constantinople, but the emperor controlled the proceedings. The arrangements were stacked against the West. Of the 165 bishops who signed the acts of the council at its final meeting on June 2nd, not more than 6 would have been from the West. In protest against that and other irregularities, Pope Vigilius refused to attend. The 3 chapters by Nestorius were anathematized, but as we have seen, they had nothing directly to do with Origen. Of the 14 anathemas produced by the council, Origen's name is mentioned in 1, among a list of heretics. But there is some evidence that justifies a belief that this is an interpolation, as someone put it in later. And the what is it? What were we called? Nestorianism. Mm-hmm. What was his?
He claimed
anxiety
that Jesus. It was basically Jesus as God. It has to do with divinity of Christ again.
Okay.
He was in favor of calling Theotoke or Theotokos was the name of Mary. She's the bearer of God. But he was opposed to that. He said she can't be the bearer of God. She has to be the bearer of God's son, of Jesus. So
Nestorian was saying.
I believe that was his.
Okay. Yeah. So he was making it that there's God and there's the Father and the Son rather than he
that
is
they're
God.
Separate rather than the Orthodoxy believed that they should be the same. They were in favor of keeping Mary's name as Theotokos.
Okay.
Yeah.
But then if she is the bear, then that means that she has a special position. So what is she?
Yeah. Well, she's either the Father of God or the Father, Mother of God or Mother of Jesus. That's basically the main.
And then what's her relationship with God, or what's her divinity? Just mother of, okay, but what's her position? Is she transcendental? Does it get into that? Or?
I'm not sure.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I'm sure they're still fighting over
just
it.
Just a vessel.
Just a vessel. Okay. Of a pre-existing soul or not?
For the Catholic, she is divine.
She's divine.
Yeah, it's Holy Mary.
Okay. But I think amongst the Protestants, she's not so holy.
There was a Protestant leader in Brazil who kicked the image of Mary, and he really had trouble. He was lost. Anyway, he had so much money that he had trouble.
I mean, why her? Why not someone else? Why not Britney Spears or something? Why her? Or Madonna, right? You know, what's she doing with that name? So why that one? Yeah. And it's Brazil. Was there a shortage of soccer balls or something? He had nothing else to kick. Brazilians have to kick something. It's just inherent nature. Just have to kick.
Doctrine of origin, more or less.
The what?
Origin.
What's the origin of origin?
Yes. Yes.
What do you mean?
He wants to know what was his doctrine?
Well, it's still debated whether he was explicitly for reincarnation. Everything he said was it was somewhat vague, but it was definitely leaning in that direction. So most people consider that he was pro reincarnation.
He was pro reincarnation body.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is time, but now this is 300 years later. Yeah. Come on, you got to get with it. You know, it's like that.
Well, that's why everybody rose up, like in Gaul and North Africa. They said, "How can you condemn Origen? He's one of our main theologians."
Yeah, because otherwise, if that's there, then they'll condemn this at some point. You know, so it's just.
That's why Pope Vigilius refused to have anything to do with it.
Okay. Yeah. But then they lost out, 2 to 165.
Yeah.
Yeah. Note that the Pope was not even present at this historic event. He had completely opposed the Emperor's convening this council. Refusing the Emperor's call to Constantinople, Pope Vigilius secluded himself in a church sanctuary. The council went on without him. In May and June 553, the Pope hid from May to December. Finally, the next year, on 23rd February 554, he surrendered. He officially ratified the council's verdict of the previous year. The result? Chaos. The churches in the West rebelled. Some dioceses even closed communication with Rome until the 7th century. Wow, 200 years. In Africa, imperial troops had to force acceptance of the edicts. The overall outcome was so inconclusive and dubious that some modern Catholic scholars question whether the anathemas laid down by that particular council are actually binding on Catholics. Yet the tragedy is that ever since, Christians have taken it for granted that reincarnation is a forbidden doctrine. They hear that the Fifth Ecumenical Council slammed the door on a whole caboodle. Okay. Okay. I was trying to think, wow, what's this fancy word now? Oh, it's caboodle. Okay. On a whole caboodle of Gnosticism, Origenism, Reincarnationism, and other deviancies of the day, all lumped together. By the time of the Council of Lyons in the 13th century, and the Council of Florence in the 14th, so these were also part of the seven ecumenical?
Catholic.
Oh, these are within the Catholic. Okay, yeah. These are beyond the seven.
Yeah.
Okay.
The seven ended in 700 AD.
Oh, okay. So it never made it into the...
Middle Ages.
Yeah. So by the time of the Council of Lyons in 13th century and the Council of Florence in the 14th, it was assumed that the body of beliefs handed down by the apostles denied reincarnation. Thus, these councils insisted that the soul goes non-stop to heaven or hell, or else purgatory, to further prepare for heaven. So what's the difference between hell and purgatory?
Purgatory is the preparatory, it's the in-between area.
The judgment.
Where, yeah, you're in the middle.
Purgatory is judgment.
You wait for judgment there.
You wait for judgment, and what's it like in purgatory?
Not so good.
Purgatory is for small sin. Somebody dies with a venial sin, a small sin, goes to purgatory, and it's like hell for a couple of weeks. Or he's purified of that, then he goes to heaven. But if he dies with a mortal sin, without confessing, then he goes to hell forever. The purgatory is like a temporary hellish condition.
Okay, because you always hear about purgatory, that it's, but that means more of a short term. Okay, in other words, you know, going to work today could be purgatory. But, okay, yeah. Okay. The Protestant dropped purgatory. The Catholics kept all three, and that's where things stand today. Okay. Christians must find their way to accept that the soul does not exist before birth. This notion, of course, leads to the question how and where from a soul manifests every time a new baby is born. Regardless of the attempted answer, one shot to stay out of everlasting damnation is all the soul gets. It's only confession. So that means anyone, anywhere, if they confess, then they're good. So that means you could do anything you wanted, all light, as long as you had the conviction you were going to confess before you died. I mean, that would work unless you got, like, run over by a truck or something. Then you don't really have a whole lot of opportunity there, right? Yeah. But now, who you confess to, let's say, is okay, the Catholic is there, but then you have a Protestant. Now, just being a Protestant according to the Catholics would be considered, you know, good enough to go to hell for. But now the point is if he confessed, then he could be relieved from that, technically, no? But then the problem is who does he confess to? I guess that's what it means.
Well, that was the main objection that Martin Luther had with the Catholic Church, is that they were charging for penances. Is that you could put down, you'd pay a certain amount of money and be absolved of the sins. And so...
But you didn't have to confess.
Well, it was part of, I suppose...
Part of the confession.
But it was always to the priest. And that's why the Protestant order overthrew, or they sought to get rid of that intermediate order of priesthood and the Pope in order to have a direct connection to...
Okay, so whatever semblance of parampara was left, they successfully removed.
In the extreme brand of...
Yeah, okay. Though the fullness of what Origen believed about reincarnation is not always clear, his sympathies are obvious to all who studied his works. The exact scope of his beliefs is clouded, more by his future friends than enemies. After Origen's death, oh, you mean the future friends clouded it so that it wouldn't be, all his books wouldn't be burned or something.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Okay. After Origen's death, wary scribes allowed potentially radical passages to disappear, exercising a sort of informational censorship to protect Origen's stature. They did not copy anything that might subject the departed leader to chances of heresy.
Charges
of heresy. According to the Catholic Encyclopedia, what Origen taught closely resembled what the Platonists, Jewish mystics, and Vedic sages accepted. Here's the passage that remains. By some inclination towards evil, certain spirit souls come into bodies, first of men, then due to their association with the irrational passions, after the allotted span of human life, they are changed into beasts, by which they sink to the level of plants. From this condition, they rise again through the same stages and resort to their heavenly place. Okay, so kind of had an understanding. Was Origen actually or properly condemned for teachings like this? Some say that the process of anathema was never applied, or it was revoked, or it was illegitimately executed. Additionally, the reluctant Pope Vigilius is said to have had no real gripe with Origen. The Pope is even said to have opposed nailing Origen until caught in the emperor's web of theopolitics. Owing to this fog surrounding Origen's fall from grace, today some Christians conclude that they may safely adopt Origen's concepts. The Catholic Encyclopedia acknowledges the stance. In other words, it does not exist.
It does exist.
Okay. How did they get not? Where did that come from? In the modern time, the internationally known Cardinal Desire Joseph Mercier, that's his name? Means desire? What's that?
It's probably French, though, Marc. Désiré.
Oh, okay.
Joseph Mercier.
Oh, okay.
French,
okay. Was among those who say reincarnation has never been formally condemned by the Roman Catholic Church. It would seem that anyone can read the Bible and see that. Like the doctrine of the Trinity, the Bible either explicitly promulgates reincarnation nor directly objects to it. Some verses, though, seem to acknowledge it.
So, Maharaj, it's where after reading all these things, there is nothing more clear. It's not clear.
Yeah, it's not clear amongst them. In other words, then one can, the only thing that comes up clear is that if we're discussing in our preaching the reincarnation element, you don't have to worry that it's going to be against basically Christian sentiments, because it's not technically clear whether it's officially banned or not. Right? Because I remember I think it was in, Maharaj used to ask in Poland when he do programs how many people there believed in reincarnation. Now, at the time, then Poland was 98% Catholic. Right, so basically everyone who was there was Catholic, and basically at least 60% or more believed in it. You know, so it wasn't, you know, so it can work. Yeah, all the point is that if you don't have papra parampara, you don't have the clearness. So that's why the acharyas are very much bringing out the clearness and the clarity. So you have the scripture, then you have commentaries that bring it out. Because that's the point, is there's no commentaries. Someone writes some stuff, but then he gets thrown out.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, yes.
There's a show, some of his disciples wanted to protect him by editing his books, so
yes,
it's less heretical.
Yes, yes.
So that's also...
Yeah, you always have that kind of thing. You know, so you have to be very careful. You know, I'm sure that there's, you know, there might be somewhere where they have these works, but, you know, no one's going to know about them. Because, you know, the point is they know about it and they come and burn your library down, so you don't want to talk about it. Okay, so then we'll stop here. We got to Christianity and classical literature. Classical means?
Greco-Roman.
Oh, okay. Okay. No, it's not Christianity and Mozart or something.
Not yet.
No. Okay. I mean, they do agree on some points. So. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada ki,
yeah.
Samavita Bhaktivedanta ki,
yeah.
Jainitai Gaura Premanandi.